And on to the question, which is much more cheery, which is a practical demonstration of the operations of state monopoly capitalism in the modern era. And why don't you tell us what that's all about?
Yeah, so before we had the vax mandates or vaccination passports announced in various places, we were going to do a show on what's happened to the pharmaceutical industry under the current age of decaying monopoly capitalism. And just looking at a specific article from ProPublica, about how the FDA is funded in majority by industry user fees and how that's affected the development of drugs over time. And so I guess the first thing is that we wanted to kind of give a broader view of what happens to innovation and science writ large under monopoly capitalism. And then we're going to talk specifically about the pharmaceutical industry by using the information from this article, which we'll link in the show notes. So we've mentioned a few times, like, we're both Leninists. We both agree with Lenin's theory of imperialism. And a part of that is the way in which the state and the banks and industrial capital and commercial capital merges into one. And this is because as capitalism progresses, more and more of individual capitalists merge. So they monopolize and they become bigger and bigger. And so now at this point, for instance, you'll have just like a few major firms that control all of the mining in Canada, for instance. But whereas before you would have had many smaller ones. Okay, so this whole kind of Amazon type progression too of killing small business and, you know, taking the business for themselves. This is part and partial of capitalism under imperialism. And all capitalism now is essentially monopoly capitalism. It has been for a while. There isn't really any competition at the lower levels anymore as much. Like the main sources of competition movement that you see under modern day capitalism are between the states. So one state which represents a certain set of monopoly capitalists will be rising and competing against another state that's failing. And you have this up and down movement, which is where any progress, any change that we see under a current era comes from. In addition to working class struggle, but right now, because it's low, that's where the kind of progress is coming from. So that's like the big picture. So what happens with these at a state level, the monopolies that depend on individuals, nation states to support them will capture entire markets for themselves and they'll divide the market amongst each other. So what they're able to do in that circumstance is to fix prices. So as Lenin said, quote, since monopoly prices are established, even temporarily, because of course there's still some movement under imperialism via the movement of the competition of imperialist states, the motive cause of technical and consequently all other progress disappears to a certain extent, and further, the economic possibility arises of deliberately retarding technical progress. So unless you have a working class that is pushing capitalists to innovate, absent that, you have essentially the only source of movement, of progress, intra-capitalist competition. But under imperialism, that is very much kind of abstracted at a higher level. And you do have moments where one imperialist state will be on top and they're up there for a while. And during that time, they start to decay. And that's what's happening right now, for instance, in the United States. You have the United States that's been the head honcho for actually much longer than it would have been otherwise, since the USSR was there for a while. That caused a bit of a shift in the way in which imperialism functions. But it's been decaying even still. So it's been able to maintain its dominant position, like American hegemony, for a while, but it's been decaying for a while. And so as a result, we've seen like the disappearance of progress. And that is kind of the view of it. That's the kind of way in which Leninists view innovation under imperialism. Like it's not completely gone. Some of it still happens, but a lot of it doesn't happen. And some of it that does happen ends up being nullified because of the different ways in which monopoly capitalists compete against one another. Did you want to jump in, Alex? I'll talk for a while.
Yeah, the question of like how the state is organized comes in here because the as you were saying, the merger of money capital and industrial capital to form finance capital, which then merges with the state, was a common trend across the European imperialist powers in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And as we motored through the 20th century, and we're talking specifically here about the United States, but you can also apply this to Britain, France, Germany, any of the advanced capitalist nations. All of the tendencies identified by Lenin in the text from 1916, Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, all those tendencies increased. So what we're going to be talking through in the details here is just how just one practical application of this, which is when you get the merger of money and industrial capital, and then you get the merger with the state machine, you get something that looks very much like the United States government at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Not only is it the case that the ruling class interests exert the dominant force in the capitalist state, of course they do, but also that the finance capital and its personnel merge with the state in terms of them being the personnel of the state and also the big financial capitalist firms.
Yeah.
This is something which we'll see is true in the case of the Food and Drug Administration. It's also true in the case of what the Americans particularly call the military-industrial complex, which is essentially a shorthand term for like the operation of like state monopoly capital in the arms industry. And it's true in every other form of a major form of economic activity as well. Like this isn't just a case that the capitalists have captured the state. They are the state.
Yes.
And this isn't, I mean, some say, I hear a lot of people who are influenced by libertarianism say, oh, that's fascism. No, that's state monopoly capitalism as it grows up in the imperialist period. And yes, sometimes in various extreme circumstances, they have turned to fascism to defend that. But that's a formation that emerges naturally when capitalism moves into away from the period of free competition, which it did a long time ago, into the imperialist period. So let's always be clear about the terms we're using and like what we're referring to here. State monopoly capitalism is the reality in every single major advanced capitalist nation. There's no one who's outside of it. It has different national forms.
Yeah.
But the broad strokes are the same. Mm. The way it's organized is the same. And there's no area of major economic activity which is immune to this.
Yeah. And what it means when the state merges with industry and banking is it means that the state is not is now using its power and its tools to support monopoly capitalism. So now it participates in the type of suppression of free competition that monopoly capitalists require in order to maintain themselves. So, for instance, what we're seeing right now with the way in which the Fed is stabilizing markets by funneling trillions of dollars into bond markets, for instance, like that is because monopoly capitalists need to put in such a big upfront investment into whatever they're making. And that they, in order to be assured profits, they need to know for sure that they're going to have a consumer base, or else it's going to be a disastrous loss for them because so many billions of dollars need to be invested into upfront costs because your monopoly capital is so big. And so they can't deal with a economic recession that is very severe. That's why governments have been, that's part of the reason why actually governments have been putting in a lot of money more and more over the last few decades into stabilizing consumer markets. So that's a part of the reason why, for instance, that they put a rent moratorium in many places in this world, including the United States, because they couldn't just have a bunch of people just suddenly be kicked out of their homes, lose their jobs, etc., which would lead to a domino effect and create like a very bad depression, because that would basically like be a disaster at this point in capitalism. Like the monopoly capitalists that dominate these economies can't take that. They need stability, they need predictability, And that's part of what the states provide them. And we see this very clearly, actually, with the pharmaceuticals. Like, this is a lot of what the states are doing. But essentially, the states have become, what they do is that their role has qualitatively shifted to support monopoly capitalism, which functions differently than industrial capitalism. And so the state's functions have changed as well. That's why the state has actually gotten a lot bigger over the last few decades, like since imperialism started in around the 1910s, the stage of capitalism called imperialism, according to Lenin. It's because before, free competition was actually a mode through which suited industrial capitalism. That actually worked out for them. So countries that had like a smaller state actually did much better in that era. So for instance, the UK, but in that era. But now things have changed. Anyways, maybe we can get into talking about pharmaceuticals.
Just one more thing on that. Like the UK got away with having like a relatively small state machine because we were the first capitalist nation. And therefore, like we, along with like possibly with like France and certain areas of Germany and Belgium, but like the UK had like a fairly minimal state, though it did use an awful lot of state power to coerce people off the land and into factories. But it had this sort of fairly minimal state because it basically had no competitors. Had very few competitors, and it could make its money without actually needing to build up a big state machine. Now, when you get later on to a country like the newly unified Germany under Bismarck, they had to have a much more developed state machine because they were actually developing capitalism at a later stage than Britain, France, Belgium, or the United States. And this is what happens with a lot of later developed capitalist economies that go on to have any remote amount of success. They have to have a much bigger state machine to start off with because they're trying to essentially protect their markets and build up an economic base at a time of imperialism, at a time of vast inter-imperialist rivalry. So anybody who wants to develop capitalism now has to have a much more extensive state machine than anything like the British or even the early American state had. So like, and a reason, one of the reasons why like dim-witted British economists go around going, everybody needs to develop with the minimal state is just because like either A, they're too stupid to realize what happens in the imperialist period, or B, you know, telling everybody in the developing world that you need a minimal state and open markets. Well, that works when there's nobody to compete with you. It doesn't work when you've got three major imperialist powers coming in, buying up all your natural resources and occupying your markets. So the lack of course, capitalism, the capitalists and most of the leading imperialist nations don't want people to have that level of understanding. But the more that capitalism develops, the more complex it gets, the more that even the new entrants into it need a very extensive state machine just to be able to play on anything like a level footing.
Yeah, exactly. Like what the UK really benefited from, and the USA, for instance, is a very strong bourgeoisie. And so for in the era of industrial capitalism, they actually did benefit from like a smaller state at that point. Whereas France, you know, after Napoleon won, the bourgeoisie kind of got super weak. And so they needed like a more powerful administrative apparatus at home, which explains the difference in the size of the state between France and say the UK or England. But now like we're outside of that, like those kind of differentiations don't matter anymore. Every capitalist state was going to undergo a bourgeois revolution has done so. In terms of a progressive bourgeois revolution, that time is pretty much done. The states have now taken up the role that monopoly capitalists need them to take up, which is being very big and very intrusive and basically guaranteeing their profits. And we're going to see this very clearly with the pharmaceutical industry. Okay, so what is the pharmaceutical industry, first of all? Yeah, so it used to be pretty common knowledge, actually, that pharmaceutical companies were not benevolent deliverers of health. Actually, pharmaceuticals create commodities in the form of medicines, like any other form of productive capital. They're not, they're just, they're in a business. Their priority is not to make sure that you're healthy and happy. It's to make sure they make money for their stockholders.
Wait, hang on. Are you saying that the likes of Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer might be acting in somebody else's interest other than mine?
Yeah.
Well, I'm shit.
Sorry to tell you this. I know this is probably as shocking for you, Alex, as it was learning that Santa Claus doesn't exist, but...
No, you can't. Don't get that. But, but I was assured by editorials in Jacobin magazine that being forced to take untried and experimental drugs was a good thing. In fact, it was part of the fight for socialism.
It's so good, Alex, that we have to mandate it. That's how good it is.
It's so good, we have to tell you that you have to take it.
It's so good that you literally, that Jacobin magazine literally wants to enlist small capital to pressure you to take this vaccine. That's how good it is. They're willing to ally themselves. Yeah,
it's so good they're prepared to form a cross-class alliance in order to force people to take it.
Yeah, they're willing to ally themselves with their natural enemies, the small businessmen. To force the proletariat to take this vaccine. That is how good it is. It's so good, you don't even know how good it is. You have to take it to find out. So it used to be common knowledge that pharmaceutical industries were just businesses out to make some money. But that is actually still the case. That hasn't changed. And just like any other business, they have to invest capital into their whole thing. And pharma's capital is, as any other capitalist, made up of fixed and variable capital components. And so the fixed costs consist of things like buildings and like ingredients for their medicines and other components. And the variable component is wages and salaries of their staff. Okay. So pharmaceutical industries are by definition involved in a higher risk endeavor. So, for other commodities, so medicine is a commodity, but for other commodities, a lot of the time, you can pretty much know for sure that your commodity will have a use value in the general population. That's not the same thing for medicines. Like sometimes you're going to develop and research a medicine and it's just going to end up in a dead end. And actually that is the fact for the vast majority of medicine throughout the period, throughout the history of medical research. A lot of the research just ends up in a dead end and there's no product that can be taken to market. And so in a situation of true innovation, if pharmaceutical companies were involved in a truly innovative search for new medicines and breaking frontiers, et cetera, they're going to see a huge amount of variable capital just wasted. Okay. So a huge amount of wages and salaries of their staff just wasted. Okay. And so for pharmaceutical companies, despite their pretensions, actually any discoveries and inventions that cannot generate profit is a waste. It's a waste for them. Okay. And so they don't want to actually do it. They don't actually want to do that innovative research because it's a waste for them. Most of it will be a waste. 99% of it will be a waste. And so another element that pharma companies face is that they aren't completely shielded from competition, even though we have just a few big pharma companies that exist. That's, it's called big pharma because they're so monopolized. And the reason why they are is because it's a higher risk intrinsically for medicines versus other commodities. And so they, more than other companies, want to get those super profits, right? So if they're able to get their drug the first to market before any of their other competitors, okay, they're going to be able to make super profits, which is a profit that is over and above the average rate of profit that exists. And so, that is what justifies for them the higher risk that is involved in the development of medicines, okay? And so, what are companies trying to do here, pharmaceutical companies trying to do here? They're trying to, at once, minimize the amount of actual innovation and actual risky research that they're doing as much as possible. And on the other hand, they're trying to get whatever they do discover and develop out to market first. So, these are the two main drivers that are involved that are kind of unique to the pharmaceutical industry, okay? So what is pharma decide to do, okay? So they plan research as much as possible, and they do so via the completely unscientific extrapolation of current trends, right, that exists. So in order to, you know, buffet their chances as much as possible. So a lot of their actual products are not actually that scientific per se, because they're kind of, they premise a lot of their research on like false premises based on like past research. So we're not really going to talk about that element as much, but they do plan research as much as possible, which is antagonistic to a true innovative process. You can't plan innovation, right? You have to just try new things and see how it goes. And also, like, they engage in regulatory capture in order to bring down barriers to taking their drugs to market first, okay? So what pharmaceuticals do as a result of the pressures that they're faced with uniquely, unique perhaps to other monopoly capitalists, is that they, number one, try to reduce their risks involved in medical research, and they try to reduce their barriers to bringing whatever they do discover to market first. And the regulatory capture is what we're going to be looking at in specifically when it comes to the FDA.
Right. So the the claim that is always made by defenders of capitalism is that, well, we have to have a private ownership of the means of production, because otherwise, well, we just wouldn't get any innovation. We just wouldn't. The capitalism is defended specifically on the basis that private ownership means more innovation. And looking even at a cursory glance at the pharmaceutical industry would suggest that actual innovation isn't generally speaking, isn't going on. What they're doing is they're essentially finding either something with a big niche demand, or they're finding something that's possibly in the headlines, or they're trying to, or in some cases they're trying to generate markets for something that they've created already. But a lot of the time they're not innovating, and where even where they are producing something of value, as with many drugs that become subject to mass consumption, it's often the state which is underwriting an awful lot of their costs. The risks the risks when it comes to innovation, they frequently look to dispose of onto somebody else while still taking the reward. And this is certainly true of the things like the COVID vaccinations as well, that the risk has been transplanted onto the state and away from the pharmaceutical companies. So risk in innovation under capitalism might have existed at one stage, and believe it probably did exist. It has existed at certain stages, but it certainly doesn't exist in this stage in capitalism now, not generally.
Well, you can't just, if you subsume your creative process to profit generation, of course you're not going to have a real creative process. Like, you need to be able to take risks and actually do things that will be completely useless. Like, that is part of true innovation. Like, innovation is actually quite difficult. And I think innovation is impossible under capitalism. Like, true innovation is impossible under capitalism for a lot of different reasons. Like, I think you really do need a truly democratic and egalitarian structure to do real science and do good science. But part of the reason is, yeah, like, if in the final analysis, the only thing that matters is things that can make a profit, then there's a ton of things that will just be set aside. And, you know, in other areas of industry, like, so for instance, like Lenin brings up the example, and in his book Imperialism, he brings up the example of a bottle making company in the United States, I think, that just purchased a patent for a new bottle making machine and just pigeonholed it in order to prevent that competition from competing against their monopoly, right? So you have like all of these like forces, like these contradictory forces that like, and a lot of them actually like stop any innovation that actually does arise, right? By like buying patents and then just burying them, and in order to maintain one's dominance within a monopoly market. And pharmaceuticals specifically, like Mariana Mazzucato, who is a capitalist, she's a capitalist economist, as she proudly says, wrote a great book about this, The Entrepreneurial State. and shows how much initial research is actually done by state funded institutions. Like, for instance, a lot of the initial research done for the mRNA vaccines were done in the United States at the National Institute of Health Research Labs. So they offload any of the real super high risk research, they offload it as much as possible onto the public purse to begin with. They do a bit of research, but actually a lot of it is focused on like what's called Me Too drugs. So these are slight variations on existing drugs. And they put a lot of their research into like marketing research. If that can be, like, our development, which is clinical trials. So they do actually still put a lot of money into development, but that is like, so the research and development, the development side of things, but that is just to get their drugs to market. Okay. So it is kind of a marketing, it fits into that marketing side of things. The research part of it is very much taken out of the, has been taken out of the pharmaceutical industry. It's very much on the public purse, but even that research is, you know, any other day subsumed to the needs of profit production. So it's not super innovative in a true sense. Pharmaceutical companies will like always justify their very high prices by saying, oh, we need to cover a very high research and development costs. But yeah, the fact is very like actual innovative drugs with new formulations like the mRNA vaccines were first developed in the university sector, in the public lab sector. Pharmaceuticals just like were able to get that research as Mazzucato underlines in a whole variety of research, industries. They just capture that initial research that was done on the public purse and then just privatize it for themselves and then make all the profits. That's and we get to enjoy paying very high prices for these medicines, and we should be grateful for it too, which aren't even safe, as we're going to go through in this show. All right, so let me we'll start talking about the FDA specifically.
Yeah, and a classic case of what's popularly, well, referred to in some circles as regulatory capture.
Oh, yeah. This has been what's that thing? Pokemon. Pharmaceuticals have really gotten this Pokemon, the FDA. What? Yeah.
I have no idea what any of that means.
It's more of a North American thing.
Well, I know. I'm aware that Pokemon is a thing. I'm aware that, like, grown men for a while 5 years ago were chasing imaginary digital creatures, yes, on their phones. I'm aware that Hillary Clinton once said we're going to Pokemon go to the polls, then promptly deservedly lost an election.
So the pharmaceutical companies, so just to kind of put this in verbiage that, you know, the millennial generation can understand, pharma has Pokemon go to the FDA.
I think you lost the audience there. If anybody's still listening, this is the moment where the show falls apart.
No, it's good. We'll carry on. We'll carry on.
Okay. I think we can end the Pokemon analogies.
Okay.
Though.
All right. Fine.
I think we might have kept some millennials, but I think the Zoomers have given up on us.
No, Zoomers don't listen to this show. The true lost generation. Anyways, we're gonna have our critique on the Zoomers soon. All right. So, all right.
Yeah, we're gonna have Hassan Piker on to debate.
Is he a Zoomer? I think he's 32, actually.
Yeah, he's a pretend Zoomer. Yeah. Like, he got declared like the voice of Zoomers, much like Owen Jones was declared the voice of Millennials.
Yeah, he's 30. He's not a Zoomer. He's a Millennial. Okay. All right. So now that we've addressed that important issue,
and the Pokemon issue, almost as awkwardly as Hillary Clinton.
We're going to understand how the pharmaceutical industry actually did go get the FDA and capture it. All right. So the FDA actually once upon a time was one of the best medicines review agencies in the world. Okay. It actually was very good. Unlike many other drug administration and review agencies in this world, including the European one, it actually looks at the raw data itself directly. So it asked the pharmaceutical agencies, like, we don't want you to just give us your analyses and your own stats on the data that you've collected during your trials. We want the raw data itself, and we're going to do our own analysis. Okay. And that's why the FDA has had actually historically quite a big impact and influence on other agencies across the world. That don't do that themselves. Like they don't have the capacity to do it, but the FDA was initially founded to do so. So it was initially quite good. But in recent times, and including now, it's being assailed for being too slow. Like it's being assailed for taking too much time to approve drugs. And so it's actually been getting faster and faster in regards to approving drugs over the last like few decades. So at this point now, the FDA reviews drugs much more quickly than it did before. So between 2011 and 2015, the FDA reviewed new drug applications more than 60 days faster than even the European Medicines Agency. It's actually very fast. And it has become faster by requiring less evidence to support an approval. So now it only requires like one clinical trial instead of the usual two. It had required a lot of the time for a lot of drugs. So this is what happened with the COVID vaccines. So usually vaccines, the FDA normally over the last few decades has required two pivotal clinical trials for safety and efficacy. And they would need a follow-up for each of them of at least 6 months. And so overall, the total total amount of time that they would need for safety and efficacy was 2 years for a vaccine, for vaccines historically speaking. So for the COVID vaccines, they gave it authorization to be used by most people with 8 weeks of this. And so in return for this accelerated approval, the drug companies have to then commit to researching how well the drugs work after going to market. Okay. So the FDA is acknowledging in this, arrangement that it doesn't really know for sure how safe or efficacious these drugs are. And so they're like, okay, you have to give us, post-marketing studies, but these can take like 10 years or longer to complete. And so, like, we're all left, as with these COVID-19 vaccines, with, like, questions about how safe and efficacious these drugs actually are. And we won't really know, for instance, for COVID-19, they don't have to submit the safety and efficacy clinical trial data for pregnancy and other things until, like, 2025.
And just to be clear, the FDA asks the drug companies to report back, basically, if there's any problems with it. And frequently, the drug companies don't even do that.
Yeah, they often just don't do it. And often is the case that the FDA doesn't penalize them for it. Because they'll be like, well, if they're not deliberately delaying submitting this information, then we're not going to penalize them for it. You know, things happen. You know, Alex, things happen.
Yeah. Life comes at you fast.
Yeah.
And more to the point, share prices come at you fast, too.
You know,
but
you start...
On the question of the FDA's process, it's also worth emphasizing that in the article we're talking about here that sort of inspired us to do this episode on this particular topic, it mentions that the internal culture of the FDA is entirely built around supporting the industry. Like the awards, internal awards, including like bonuses and stuff like that in the FDA, go to people who support the industry. It's like it's seen, and including one like senior FDA figure was quoted as being concerned that if they didn't approve a drug, that the company making it wouldn't be able to recapitalize themselves and might go bankrupt. So this is what's happened. Not only is it the case that the pharmaceutical companies exercise an influence here, it's that internally the entire culture is built around boosting the profits of the pharmaceutical industry and supporting the industry.
Yeah, and you can see this process happening at very specific moments in history. Like, so I just want to go through a really quick timeline of the evolution of the FDA. and where it started, where it is right now, and the pivotal moments that change the way in which it's funded, which is the reason why, like, the change in its funding structure is the reason why it now takes less time to review drugs and needs less evidence than it did before. It all comes down to funding. So there was a big event in 1960 with a drug called thalidomide, which is a drug that was prescribed to pregnant women to prevent day sickness, nausea. And it actually caused like thousands of babies to be born in the early 60s with stunted limbs. And so then Congress entrusted the FDA with ensuring that drugs going to market would be both safe and effective based on substantial evidence from multiple trials. So it was in response to that event where pharma, in all of their benevolence, maimed thousands of children because they wanted to make money. So it's been happening for a while, people. I don't understand. Yeah. The only reason it wasn't happening as much is because the FDA, you know, since the 60s was requiring that, you know, drugs, pharmaceutical companies actually show that their drugs are safe and effective with real data, okay? But the problem is that in the 1970s, the FDA's responsibilities expanded. And this started to bring more time lags to approving medications. And by 1979, it was more than 35 months on average from, you know, submitting approval for a drug to it actually getting approved and being available for people to buy it. And so it's not the fact that the FDA is actually reviewing things that is the problem. The problem is that they were given more responsibilities and not having their funded expanded concurrently, okay? And so they were just doing more with the same amount, okay? And that's why it was taking more and more time for drugs to be approved. And this really came to a head in the late 80s. So in 1988, ACT UP, which is an HIV advocacy group, tried to take over the FDA's headquarters in Rockville, Maryland. And this was in addition to a huge protest movement around the FDA's, so what they perceived, like the FDA's inability to push through accelerated approval for effective HIV drugs. So this whole thing was kind of seized upon by pro-pharmaceutical industry groups that had been agitating for less regulation in order to get their drugs to market as fast as possible. They seized upon the HIV crisis epidemic to say, yes, you see, the FDA is killing people because it's taking so much time to get these approvals out. And so, of course, the answer from these folks and from the state wasn't to give more funding to the FDA. It was the Prescription Drug User Fee Act of 1992. So this was a major change in the way the FDA was funded. It established industry user fees to fund FDA staff salaries. Okay, so egregious.
Sounds like a great idea.
So egregious. And in return, the FDA promised to review drugs within 12 months for normal applications and 6 months for priority cases. And so basically now you have a situation where the majority of the FDA's budget is actually funded by industry user fees. So the quid pro quo is that the pharmaceutical companies will pay money to the FDA to review their stuff, and they get to have like standards that they want the FDA to reach. They're able to negotiate those standards. Okay, so obviously this isn't going to turn out well. Like, it's like giving the chickens to the fox to take care of, essentially. And as Alex was mentioning, the article that we linked to goes through a lot of different examples of the way like this has created major pressures within the staff of the FDA to approve drugs and negative pressures on those that don't approve them. Like, so for instance, you'll get the top bureaucrats that have been promoted up the chain in the FDA are all pro-industry. They've had to be, right, in order to get that promotion. Because if you, you know, don't approve a drug, you get a lot of like negative feedback, you get a lot of questions asked. But for instance, if you do approve a drug, like departments that approve drugs very quickly get like prizes and like, you know, whatever, like, you know, other forms of positive feedback, it very much like works into the type of type of structure that bureaucracies writ large have under capitalism, but very specifically in the FDA, the link between industry and the bureaucracies is extremely clear. You know, it's not even dissolved, like obscured as much as you would between the state bureaucracy and industry writ large. And so finally, in 1997, the Prescription Drug User Fee Act was reauthorized, and they lowered the goal for review times even more, from 1 year to 10 months. And that,
and all of this, by the way, is dressed up as like that they just want to help people who are ill.
Yeah, they'll have like drug companies will pay family members of people who are seeking treatments for their family members that are sick with like diseases that don't yet have effective treatments, and they'll pay for them to go in and testify in front of Congress and like cry and be like, I just want to get my dad this treatment for, like, I don't know, Parkinson's disease, but the FDA is blocking it. It's blocking it for no reason. And so they use all these different tactics, including what I've described, to pressure the government to bring down these standards even more. And 2012, they added a new designation called a breakthrough therapy, which enables FDA to waive normal procedures for drugs that show substantial improvement over available treatments. And this is part of the reason why the COVID-19 was able to you know, waltz right through, because it's created a bunch of new accelerated pathways available for super fast drug approval. Okay. And so obviously every single drug is going to try to get that, whether or not they are truly a breakthrough therapy. Yeah.
So when you get all that, and then you also combine it with, I mean, the guy that Trump appointed to be the FDA director, Gottlieb, was a longtime pharmaceutical company employee and then went back into the pharmaceutical industry when he left the FDA. I mean, that you've got now an agency which exists to facilitate the distribution of drugs and also then basically gets to use the American population and population of other countries too, sometimes as the testing ground for it. So essentially, the risk has been put onto the American population. It's not, the risk does not belong to the drug companies anymore. Yeah. They are experimenting on all of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very much true. Like, the effects on drug safety and efficacy has been like very substantial. Like, because now we have fewer clinical trials that are required, it just means that any safety and efficacy data that we get comes with much more uncertainty. And it's very stark and clear with the COVID-19 vaccines. Like, how can we have any idea of the long-term effects of these drugs if we have like 6 months of safety and efficacy data only? It doesn't make any sense. And this is the case with more and more medicines, and has been accelerating this trend for over the last few decades. And so, like, I think this kind of doesn't make sense for like drugs that are treating rare diseases with like very severe effects. Like, so say Alex, say you had cancer and your chances of dying were like pretty high. You would be more willing to take a higher risk with the medication you're gonna try, because the risk reward benefit is quite different in that circumstance, right?
Yeah, you can understand.
Yeah,
that.
I could get that. But for a vaccine which is given to a bunch of healthy people who are not in need of a medical intervention, this makes very, very little sense. And so another thing that's happened, which I was surprised to learn about in this article, is that drugs are approved without having actually demonstrated benefit in terms of important clinical outcomes. And this is something the COVID vaccines have actually done as well. They haven't actually demonstrated benefit in terms of important clinical outcomes. So actually, still to this day, the clinical trials And they were never designed to do this, but the clinical trials have not shown a statistically significant effect on hospitalizations and deaths. We've observed that via the observational data that's been collected post application of this vaccine in places like, say, Israel. But they were approved without having to even demonstrate that. And an example that the article gives is very commonly is drugs approved for cancer treatments just have to demonstrate that they can shrink tumors, but they don't actually have to demonstrate that they, you know, save lives or they increase your life expectancy. And it's actually turned out from, you know, recent research that just because you shrink a tumor, it doesn't actually have a correlation with longer life expectancy. So these drugs don't do anything at all except create negative side effects.
And also for the just for the vaccines, when it comes to, you know, how rapidly they were produced, it's also worth bearing in mind that Trump threw $18 billion at his vaccine production project called Operation Warp Speed, typically stupid name, all overseen, of course, by a pharmaceutical lobbyist.
Yeah.
So, of course, these things were going to get approved because this is a gigantic amount of money. And Trump said repeatedly, even before COVID broke out, he was like, hey, Scott, we really want to get these times improved. There's a lot of good stuff out there. A lot of good stuff. Want to get it out to people.
Yeah.
So, like, it became a point of principle for, like, idiots and con men like Trump. That they were just doing you a favor by reducing the times under which, like, drugs could be released onto the population. Mm. And of course, the opposite is true. It's like, you know, the population becomes the testing ground for
it. Yeah, that's the whole thing about post-marketing data. Like, essentially, like, it's very expensive, actually, to construct and run a clinical trial. It requires a lot of, you know, trained, specialized people to participate in these things, like statisticians, medical doctors, biostatisticians, like drug experts, like all these different kind of roles are required to properly construct and run a clinical trial. And so they don't want to, if they can take the weight off of themselves and put it onto the governments and states to then do the tracking and efficacy studies, which has actually happened in places like Israel and otherwise, like, it's great for them. Like, they've already sold their drugs. They've already gotten the thing that they were seeking, which is super profits from getting their drug first out to market. And, like, you know, more and more drugs, because the Congress created this, like, accelerated pathway for approving drugs, like, more and more drugs, actually novel drugs that are completely new formulations that haven't yet been used in human beings on a wide scale, which includes, of course, the COVID mRNA vaccines, are being approved. So, like, an example that the article gives is, like, a really sad story of this drug called a Nuplazide in 2016, which was marketed as this, like, treatment for Parkinson's, and it failed two clinical trials. In the third one, it found a small benefit. And then, so it was...
And they went with the third one.
Yeah. And so the FDA was like, okay, that's fine. Like, we're going to... All right, that's fine. Go ahead and market your thing. And so they ended up charging, like, the patients of this, or I guess their insurance companies, $33,000 a year to take this medication. And it turns out, actually, that the medication had serious side effects. And more patients died then benefited from taking this drug. So it was actively harmful. Like, it's like this very perverse situation where capitalism is now creating medicines that hurt more than do any, like, benefit. And it's just because all of the risk, which normally would have been somewhat contained within clinical trials, that are, like, don't affect, like, everyone. It's like, you know, clinical trials are typically a few thousand people large. But now it's like millions of people have to take this risk. And, you know, we just don't know until, like, years and years later whether or not the risk was worth it. And then we're expected to feel bad about not wanting to take the risk. It's just ridiculous. Yeah. So anyways, I guess finally to wrap up or get closer to wrapping up, I guess let's look at like the how state capitalism has been demonstrated, how this theory of state capitalism has been proven by what we've described above as a pharmaceutical regulatory capture. So I mentioned at the beginning that the main two motivations of the pharma monopoly capitalists is to bring down barriers so that they can bring their drug to market first, and also to offload the high-risk research that they have to do in order to bring down their variable capital costs. So this has been demonstrated pretty specifically in the FDA. Like, that's exactly what's happened. Like, they've offloaded, with the FDA specifically, what they're doing is getting their, basically this whole process is in order to get their drugs to market as quickly as possible, okay? And like the research side of things is somewhat associated with this, but I think that the removal of their risks when it comes to research is more so to do with the way in which universities and states institutions fund the high risk research. So we can have a show about this one day. Maybe we can review Mazzucato's book, which is quite good.
Good idea.
Yeah. But anyways, so like now we have a situation where like any innovation. Any true, like, so the mRNA vaccine is innovative, is true innovation. Whether or not it actually is a bold new step for medicine is an open question. It might be. Like, we have to see whether this massive experiment that we're forcing everyone to undergo, what it will yield. But, you know, it might be a bold new step in medicine. I don't think it will be, but it might be. But the point is that the states has now had for a while taken the risks associated with doing the highly innovative research at the start of the process, and now they forced the population to take on the biological risks of testing and developing the drugs. So all the pharmaceutical companies are doing really is just like creating the drugs, like they're just like manufacturing the drugs. And a kind of a novel thing actually is now the states are taking on all of the liability associated with damages that are caused by these drugs. Very famously with the COVID-19 vaccines, like Canada, the UK, the US have taken on all of the liability associated with any damages in relation to this drug, except for deliberate malfeasance, which is not an easy thing to prove. So essentially, it's all liability. Interesting to note, too, that like it's happened, although now it's really, really coming to a T here. I think it's very egregious more. But it's been kind of a trend that started since at least the 70s, like of states taking on liability, like. In 1986, the United States passed an act called the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, which at that point removed vaccine liability for vaccine injuries. So vaccines specifically, not all drugs, but just vaccines from individual pharma companies, and established a federal no-fault system to compensate people injured by mandated vaccines. So essentially, it's like a taxpayer-funded. Well, it's a tax that's like paid by, like it's partially funded by a tax upon vaccine manufacturers. But essentially, they've like created this socialized system of like of risk for like vaccines specifically, which is also partially funded by like just taxpayer dollars. So the reason they did that actually is because pharmaceutical companies no longer wanted to take the risk of developing vaccines because they didn't want to have to deal with the damages involved in paying compensation out to those who are injured by them. And so they just stopped manufacturing vaccines. And so Congress was getting nervous that they wouldn't have any more vaccines. Like they couldn't supply vaccines. And so that's why they had to remove the risk to like make sure they had to indemnify the drug companies from further lawsuits to make sure that they could still get vaccines to give their population. So capitalism is fucked. Like it's a completely like like there's such a parasitical relationship between like, you know, specifically with the pharmaceutical companies and the population. The drug manufacturers depend on the state for innovation, for marketing too.
And for legal costs.
For indemnity. And like, so like, you know, what the FDA is doing, for instance, with this recent Pfizer approval. So it recently gave full approval for the Pfizer vaccine just earlier, or much earlier than what they said they would actually. is that it's a type of marketing. It's telling the people that, yeah, this is so safe that we've given it full approval. It's giving the sheen, the pharmaceutical monopoly capitalists are getting the state to market their products, to give their products legitimacy, you know? Like that, so, yeah. So the state is even doing the marketing. All these people do now is like make the drugs in the factories. They just produce them. And then they focus.
And then the state gets it out there.
The state gets it out there. And they focus a little bit on marketing. Like they bribe a bunch of doctors and they publish a bunch of.
Oh, yeah. The medical profession in the United States is wholly complicit in this, up to its neck in it.
Doctors are retards mostly. Like they don't know what they're doing. They have no idea of the political role that they play in society writ large. They're just trying to help people. they don't understand. They, just like other petty bourgeois people, they don't understand their role in history. They don't understand their role in class conflict. And then they focus like on, you know, publishing a few biased studies in journals, which doctors then read and get convinced by. And then they do stock buybacks in order to increase their So.
And therefore you control or like the ruling class has control of each stage of this process to sell this shit to the population. They control the production process. They control the approvals process. They control the liabilities through the state, and they control the distribution of it. And they control what the doctors prescribe, partly through like direct pharmaceutical company manipulation of like there's a big scandal now over like the Sackler family selling Oxycontin to people for over many years, which by the way Oxycontin was FDA approved. There's a big scandal because the medical company representatives were like telling doctors, I prescribe this, it's great, and that convinced some of them. Or in some cases, as you mentioned, the pharmaceutical companies end up paying for research publications into this so they can say, oh, it's peer reviewed. It's all peer reviewed when the same interests have paid for it all, or it's just another grotesque case of groupthink. And when you look into it, so much of what is done in terms of like peer reviewing is nonsense and junk science, often paid for by vested interests, that you really can't trust a lot of this.
Well, it's not made like, I think people need to understand that, like, okay, so maybe this is something you and I can discuss now, Alex. Like, obviously there is a balance that needs to be struck when it comes to drug development between speed and safety and efficacy. So I think, for instance, back in the 80s, when the HIV activists were agitating for a faster drug approval, I think they kind of had a point. Like, I think that in that circumstance, it was taking too long. But at the same time, obviously, none of us want to be given like drugs that don't work and are actively harmful. I think the only way, my thoughts on this is that this is a fundamental contradiction within and antagonism within capitalism. Okay, it's therefore it's under the influence of class warfare, and so, you know, striking a balance, I think is theoretically possible under communism, for instance, when the antagonism between private property and social good is removed, because we abolish private property, and so you collapse the individual within the collective, and so that antagonistic relationship is removed and it's sublimated into a new form. Not sublimated, it's removed, and the individual is sublimated. So I think it's theoretically possible to create drugs quickly, but also make sure that they are safe and efficient and efficacious. But I think under capitalism, actually, this push to make drugs faster just means that they're less safe. Like, that's what we are getting.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, even if back in the ProPublica article, one of the guys who was actually part of the ACT UP attempted occupation of the FDA said, well, actually, what we managed to do was play right into the hands of the pharmaceutical industry. Because where you have like a movement of people that isn't organized on a class basis, that's just exerting pressure on the system as it stands, what you will do is you will open it up for the existing balance of class forces to profit from it, which is exactly what was done with the AIDS activists pressuring for faster drug approval, the drug company stepped in and said, yes, we completely agree with you. Everything should be available within a year. Now, here's a bunch of experiments that we'll perform on you. But you can't have a solution to this under capitalism, because if they did remove the legal indemnities, if they did basically remove the subsidies, then the private companies wouldn't produce anything.
Yeah,
they'd go on producing like risk-free stuff that they could easily sell. And so you wouldn't get innovation because without being massively subsidized by the state, they wouldn't do it. Without the legal indemnity, they wouldn't do it. So unless you are some force from within capitalist politics is going to step up and unbelievably regulate the pharmaceutical industry to the point where it's basically a nationalized industry.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. Now, under a system whereby like things are produced by actual real need, then you would have it, and actually you had democratic control over the production approvals and distribution systems, then a lot of these contradictions would be removed. But at this stage of capitalism, where also like the other point worth making here is that the big pharmaceutical companies are all owned by the same people that own everything else in the United States. Like the major shareholdings in like Pfizer or Johnson & Johnson, it's all the same investment firms like BlackRock, Vanguard Group, SSGA Funds Management, and others, all of whom are investment vehicles for incredibly wealthy people or highly capitalized insurance funds or pension funds. It's the same group of people who own everything, and ultimately behind them stands the same group of banks, and behind them, ultimately flooding them with liquidity, stands the Federal Reserve, and the personnel from all of them move between the state apparatus and the banking sector and finance sector. So you see how all of these things are completely integrated into each other. And so if you pull one string on this now, if you pull out one fret, then the whole thing can become unraveled and the companies will just stop producing or threaten to stop producing.
Yeah.
So you can't unravel this under capitalism. Not unless you're prepared to have like a serious confrontation with some of the most powerful forces in the ruling class. And this is true for every form area of economic activity, not just in the United States, but in Britain, France, every other advanced capitalist country. One of the reasons why the ruling class threw a shit fit over even a character like Donald fucking Trump, who was their best friend in many ways, was because even the pulling of the tiniest of strings in this arrangement can really cause the whole house of cards to come down. And even a character like, you know, a fairly milquetoast character like Jeremy Corbyn could cause that. Not out of intention, but just by fiddling with the mechanism. As you said at the beginning of this, like state monopoly capitalism is, in many respects, an economically all-encompassing thing. It's backed up by the state, has to be constantly funded and like stabilized by the state. But at the same time, to go back to our earlier discussion, the whole thing's very fragile. And so like it has to have this level of dependability to keep the money flowing, to keep the markets open, to keep to make sure that it's the process of getting its drugs approved or maybe its weapons systems approved or anything else approved by the regulatory authority is uninterrupted. Nothing ever gets in the way, and nothing ever gets in the way of the Federal Reserve endlessly pumping liquidity into the system, and et cetera, et cetera. This is all one holistic system. And they can't have anybody fiddling with it now. So the question becomes, well, if you seek to challenge any particular part of this, you have to challenge all of it.
Yeah.
So that's why timid reformers like Elizabeth Warren end up capitulating and looking so stupid. It's because like even there, like incredibly mild, milquetoast, useless reforms in many respects, they can't have those either. Because like they can't have any interruption to business as usual. So the reformers all surrender and capitulate and just make money in the system like everybody else.
Yeah, I think the only outlook is a revolutionary outlook. Under the status quo.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is.
It's the only practical outlook. Because look at the way that this system is tied together. How are you going to pull out any one of those threads?
Yeah, it really is like under capitalism, under a state of class warfare, even in the powerful working class movement, there will still be some people that have to suffer in order for instance, for these drugs to be approved in a way that makes sense. Like, you know, like you're still going to have to reach a compromise with capital between safe speed and efficacy and safety. And so a truly pro-social and humane way of developing drugs is not possible if you have to reach a compromise with capital. We can't compromise with them because they're not, you can't compromise.
They have no interest in compromising with us. Not
on the terrain that we're interested in creating like a balance, right? We're looking to create a balance between the collective needs and individual needs. They're looking to create a balance between their collective interests. And that's it. Like, they don't actually. They just want profit. Like it's just like a completely resolvable. Like we're being forced essentially to compromise between the proletariat's collective needs, which includes individual needs, of course, and the capitalist's collective needs. Like that's the compromise that we're reaching here, right? In terms of drug production, for instance, but in terms of everything else. And so that's not going to all, that's going to mean that some individuals within the proletariat will suffer, and therefore the collective will suffer because the collective is made up of individuals, okay? And so we can't compromise on the same terrain as them. Like it's not, if we want to have a truly humane society that is based on fulfilling actual needs and enhancing one's individuality, we can't compromise with the collective of the bourgeoisie. Like we will be forced to reach some compromises at times, but absent a revolutionary outlook, like you're just being complicit in the like the harming of individuals. Sorry, like I social democracy is so stupid. Like it's such a silly way of looking at the world. Like it's Lenin was right. Like what is to be done? It's just a revolution. That's it.
Yeah, that's the only option left now.
Especially now,
and the only option that ever really existed, because social democracy just led to a hall of mirrors. And essentially, like it, I will say it again, it decayed and corroded the ability of so-called Marxists to actually properly analyze the capitalist state now for over 70 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, so now you get the ridiculous position of like so-called Marxists babbling on about the need to force people to take the offerings of Pfizer and AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson because like the state's doing it now. Therefore, that must be good. You know, let's have a... It's like these people have become retarded to the point of becoming less intelligent than a sponge.
It's so annoying that... You know what? It's such an easy position to take. Bodily autonomy as against capital always. That is a position that everyone should be taking, okay?
Well, how about this? Just don't trust the same industry that gave you the opioid epidemic. Yeah. Just, you know, maybe be skeptical about their motives.
Maybe just look at what happened with Pandemrix. It wasn't even that long ago. Okay, everyone is old enough to remember that, actually. It was just in 2009. There was also another rushed out vaccine that was administered against a disease that was overestimated in terms of its lethality. Okay, it was initially thought to be much, much more deadly than the flu. It ended up being much, much less deadly than the flu. Anything sounding familiar yet? Yeah. Like, it might actually be that COVID-19, when all is said and done, when we correct for the overestimate of deaths because of overcoding, when we get more and more serological infection data, it actually might be that it was less deadly than the flu in some places. Who knows? I don't think that's probably unlikely. But, this vaccine that they made was made off of the basis of this idea that we were in like this crazy emergency and we had to inoculate everyone against this very, very dangerous flu called the swine flu. And it actually turned out that it wasn't that dangerous, especially not when it came to children and young people. And it actually, in those age groups, created more harm than good. It gave them brain damage and it ruined the lives of so many people. And if you look at the headlines from that time, like me and Alex just wrote an article about against the vaccine mandates that will be coming out in the bellows soon. you'll see the same, like, Fauci going on YouTube in 2009 and being like, don't worry, guys, this is a really, really safe vaccine. It's one of the safest vaccines ever created.
Yeah.
He was saying the exact same thing back in 2009 as he's saying now. And all the doctors, too, were telling the nurses, this is a safe vaccine. You have to get it. You're a healthcare worker. You have to get it. No. Enough of this. The proletariat needs to make its own decision regards to these medicines for themselves. They need to make a decision for themselves. We cannot trust these people at this point in history. And so, yeah, like, history has proven that you can't trust pharmaceuticals ever. But, like, now the agencies that used to be sort of in the service of the proletariat to some degree, because they were forced to, because of a strong working class movement and the USSR, they don't serve those interests anymore. They still have the veneer of doing so because of their history. Mm. Like, the doctors still have that to some extent because of their history, right? And the FDA too, because of its history. But this is not the actual case now. They serve the pharmaceutical agencies. I'm sorry. That's all they do. They just work as marketing agencies for them, essentially, or marketing pieces. So, yeah.
Yeah, and they don't even hide it that much. You don't need to scratch the surface too much to find that the amount of people who in senior positions for the FDA who are openly celebrating the rapid approval of new and potentially risky drugs. This isn't even hidden.
Well, I mean, I think two of the main people at the FDA recently resigned in protest, actually, over the boosters. So maybe there's still something there. But I think the point is that I'm not anti-science. I'm not anti-vaccine. If this vaccine actually turns out to, as I've said, I think already in the show, if it turns out that it actually is a good vaccine, I'll take it. I'm happy to take a 1% reduction, absolute risk reduction for myself. If it's just a simple vaccine, like, that sounds great. But, like, the thing is that I don't think, though, that this is the proper way of developing a vaccine, like, putting in the risk on everyone like this and, like, rushing through, like, animal trials and all these different things. Like, that's not the way to do it. But furthermore, I think at this point in history, yeah, like, I think people need to come together and the proletariat needs to make a position for itself as to whether or not it wants to take this risk, because the risk is real. It's a real risk that you're being given. The risk has not been properly contained within a set of clinical trials. That's not what's happening anymore with the COVID-19 mRNA vaccines. So, yeah, I don't think anyone should be forced to take an unknown risk, especially if there's no societal benefit to these vaccines via herd immunity or reduction in transmission. Like, I think the proletariat needs to have this discussion for itself and make its decision for itself, like, in what it wants for itself, really. Because, like, these agencies no longer serve the public interest in any sense you might have. The only public it serves is the bourgeoisie's public. To, like, allow them to, like, buy yachts and stuff. Like, that's all that's all it's doing. Anyways, like,
yeah, a lot of fortunes build on this shit.
Yeah, and, like, these people don't even, like, freaking do anything with their fortunes anyways. Like, they're not even cool, like, the revolutionary bourgeoisie. They're not even interested in...
Yeah, they've probably all bought a few NFTs.
Yeah, me and Alex were just talking about the Gettys the other day. Like, Alex, you mentioned that was the California governor, Newsom, was...
Gavin Newsom was like the Getty's wine guy. So, you know, seeing the back of him will be hilarious if he loses.
I hope he freaking does. But, like, you know, at least the Gettys built a bunch of cool things. Like, they built the Getty Museum in Los Angeles, which is an absolute beautiful piece of architecture. But the bourgeoisie of today don't even do anything anymore. They don't do things like that. Like, they spend their money on, like, going to space. Or whatever, or going almost...
And not even getting there. Getting to the stratosphere, turning around and going back again. Like,
yeah,
just useless bunch of scumbags who couldn't even do what the USSR did 60 years ago.
Yeah, so honestly, if you... Like, I think honestly, Alex, we were writing this article. We went through a bunch of other articles written by people on the left, like Adolf Reed and the left communist at communia.blog, some left communists, definitely all the social democrats, like plenty of Marxist thinkers of various kinds have come out in favor of, for instance, vaccine mandates. These people have been compromised as well. Okay, you need to trust yourself And trust this podcast too, but mostly trust yourself. Definitely trust yourself. Don't just
trust in your own ability to reason.
Yeah, exactly. And also, like, I think honestly, people need, and it's not enough to just be on your own all the time. Like, I think it's really important to get together with other people and discuss things, because you learn much better when you are able to bounce ideas off of other people and have an open discussion out in the open. Like, that is actually the proletarian way of doing things. Like, the proletariat doesn't go and do politics hidden away, individualized in ballot boxes. Like, they discuss things in the open, have a debate, have a reasoned debate, and come to a consensus. Okay, that is the rudimentary forms that we've seen, for instance, at the trade union level. And that's the way I think that we should try to conduct our own kind of search for truth as well. I think it's very important. And it's difficult, because now you can't even raise, like, in, like, polite society, you can't even say, well, I don't know, I'm not really too sure about these vaccines. Yeah. Like, you can't even, like,
well,
raise that objection.
I think maybe impolite society might be superior.
Right. Yeah. But if you're in impolite society, or try to find those segments of society, you'd have those discussions. Anyhow, I think we've covered it, eh?
Okay, I think we've covered it. So we will link to the article in the show description. I would encourage everybody to go and read it. It's very,
it's very
interesting. It gives you a clear understanding of the nature of what the FDA is now, the process of regulatory capture, and just read it and then bear this in mind whenever they announce some sort of medical breakthrough. Bear it in mind when you're thinking about the vaccines. Like, this is the process by which things get approved now. And if you're one of our listeners in Britain and thinking that somehow we are immune to this process, I've got sad news for you. It's very much not. One of the big things that the successive governments have done is import US methods for approval of drugs into this country. And one of the big things that the US pharmaceutical companies is still desperate to do is to destroy any remaining semblance of public control over the approval process for drug distribution. It's already in the form of an undemocratic quango. We're not immune from this.
Yeah.
So this is very much, if it's not here already, it's going to be in a few years' time unless something's done about
Boris,
it.
Yeah, Boris is a man of many talents, a true Renaissance man, but drug development is something he doesn't do, so you can't depend on him for this one either.
Yeah, yeah. He, as he's proved comprehensively during COVID, if he doesn't understand something, he'll just not pay attention to it. Right, so we hope you've got something out of this extensive discussion on the vaccines, vax passports, etc. But that draws us to the close of this, the weekend edition. So until next time, we will say thank you and goodbye.
Yes, thanks very much. Till next time.